Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, April 9th, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. At the beginning of this week, Lyndon LaRouche wrote two memos and a report on the policy orientation of the LaRouche organization globally and the six LaRouche candidate slate in the United States. What he presented was his assessment of the dramatic change in politics which must occur following the results of the U.S. elections on November 2, 2010, and then again following the powerful earthquake which struck Japan on March 11th of this year, just a few weeks ago. The memo started from the gross failure of the Congress to overcome President Obama's blocking of Glass-Steagall, and both prior to the election and then during the lame duck period, and then recently, the reckless and stupid policy of the Obama administration to continue to tear down NASA and to cancel satellite programs despite clear evidence of threatening changes in the galaxy. These are just two glaring examples of Mr. LaRouche's point. One could add, for example, the foolishness of the ongoing bailout policies of the European Central Bank and the U.S. Federal Reserve, combined with demands for Hitler-style austerity, both in on behalf of governments, federal governments, national governments such as Portugal, Ireland, and the United States, as well as state governments in the United States such as California and Texas. All of these things make clear why a change in outlook is essential. But a key part of that change in outlook is what we might call the role of science in statecraft. In the face of massive shifts in bursts of gamma radiation in the Crab Nebula and an increase in the intensity of solar activity, we can no longer tolerate politics as usual. The future of our planet now depends on developing what Mr. LaRouche calls a new economic platform based on increases in energy flux density. To accept someone's opinion that the universe is governed by the second law of thermodynamics, or that we can only know things through sense perception, could be fatal to the human race, and that means fatal to you, our listeners to this program. So it's in the last week, in keeping with the spirit of these memos from Mr. LaRouche, that there's been some work done by the basement team in Virginia and by a special team of two members from the LaRouche political party in Germany, the BUSO, which attended a conference of the European Geosciences Union in Vienna. One of the leading issues in this work is that of developing the capability to forecast earthquakes, which, of course, proponents of the second law of thermodynamics deny is possible. If I said opponents, I meant proponents of the second law of thermodynamics deny that it's possible to make forecasts. So on the program today, we're going to hear from Daniel Grasenak-Tenta, who's calling in from Germany, and he's one of the anchors of the BUSO website, and he was also present at the conference in Vienna. And also joining us today is Jason Ross from LaRouche's basement team. So I'd like to begin with Daniel, who has already posted one report on the LaRouchePact.com website, and we'll have much more to come. Daniel, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Hi, Harley.
I'd like to begin with your summary report from the conference in Vienna that you attended with Stefan Tolksdorp. Give us a sense of what was going on there and the importance of the conference.
All right, sure. Well, as many people who have been following what has been published on the LaRouche PAC website and the basement reports on the Rim of Fire, especially in the context of the factor 9, the Richter scale 9 earthquake in Japan, and that there's to be expected a real increase in seismic activity over the next years. The importance of researchers that are looking into how we can come to predict or forecast or warn ourselves against impending earthquakes is enormously important. And there are teams of researchers across the world that have taken up this task, quite interdisciplinary, and they were taking part at this European Geosciences General Assembly for 2011 in Vienna, the last 2 days of which we attended. Now, in that context, it is, I just have to say at the very beginning, that given this threat and given this the nature of the kind of damage and destruction that these events cause, it was extremely notable that all of these presentations took place in the most remote parts of the conference building, in the basement, notably, and in the further the rooms most far removed from where the main activity was in the big seminar rooms. There was no recording of these presentations, and we were not allowed to record them. But we did manage to interview and talk to personally all of the different teams. Now, most specifically, there was a team centered around Michel Parot from the University of Orléans in France, which had been working with data gathered over 6 years from the Demeter satellite, which had been looking at a whole range of changes in the ionosphere, plasma, electron content, that sort of thing. Then you had an Italian delegation centered around Pier Francesco Biaggi from the University of Bari, who had basically convened the very first session and hosted the session. And they've been doing experiments with man-made radioactive electromagnetic waves. So this is just basically setting up senders and receivers across Europe in very in different frequencies. Then you had a group of a Russian-American collaboration between Sergei Pulinits from the Fyodorov Institute in Moscow and Dimitar Uzunov who's with NASA. And they've been looking at especially things that they're picking up with GPS signals, also looking at total electron content in the ionosphere. And then you had a whole delegation from Japan, which is also looking into the ground-based reception and transmission of frequencies, especially the work done by Professor Hayakawa, who people have maybe heard about. And he was represented there by the successor to his chair at the University for Communications at Tokyo, Yasuhide Hobara. And the general character of the thing is really that these are people that are engaged in a pretty young, in terms of science, it's a very young field of looking at the electromagnetic precursors, the things that go on before earthquakes actually happen. And they're coming under total attack. I mean, first of all, the seismologists really don't like the fact that people from other disciplines are encroaching upon their field of work. And this is a typical high priest reaction that we've had over the centuries of, unfortunately, bread-fed scholars have, at some point or other dominated universities, and they really don't like the fact that someone else says that they know something about their field because it challenges their structure of thought. And this is an old philosophical battle, which especially the LaRouche movement knows a lot about, because universal history is geared around the fight between the bread-fed scholar, as Schiller says, someone who defends his system, defends his construct upon which his whole career and his whole ego is based, between that and the philosophical mind, who, if no one from outside can destroy his system from which he can gain new knowledge, he himself must overthrow his system and thereby gain new insights and reconstruct it in a more perfect way.
Daniel, let me just ask you on that, because I think one thing that would be very interesting to know is that with this discussion going on in the context of the Christchurch, New Zealand earthquake, the Chile earthquake, the Indonesia earthquake, the Japan earthquake, it would seem that there would be more of a sense of urgency than to shuffle these guys off into a corner or into a basement, as you described. Was there some outrage or anger from the people who are doing this work that there's not more of an appreciation of what they're trying to do?
Well, the thing is, that's where we come in. We have to give them an awareness for the political nature of the battle that they're involved in, because they're very determined to do their work, and they know they're onto something, and they know what they've been picking up, but they feel the pressure, and they don't really know how to defend themselves against it. So there is a certain sense. They're all very clear. Much more needs to be done, but they're determined, and so they're not frustrated, and so that's why they're all very keen to be there, because that was the main way that they could network, they could get in contact with each other. But the main thing that they're saying is they can't do it. You know, these are professors, these are people who run classes. They don't have the means to set up the kind of instrumentation and stations that will be needed to get, one, a 24-hour-7 overview of all of these different phenomena mm-hmm. and measurements across the globe, on the ground, different satellites needed in space for the geomagnetic field, for the for disturbances in the ionosphere. They can't do that from the university, and governments are blocking funding to this. And
were they aware of the actions of the Obama administration to cut back on these programs?
In terms of NASA, definitely. And whenever we even dropped the word USGS, they said, "Oh yeah, don't worry. They don't want to hear anything about this. They're not interested at all." And that was their immediate, just a gut response, because I guess they've run into it a lot. But especially the Japanese have been having problems with getting any kind of state funding, because there seems to be a real skunk named Robert Geller, who, in his function at the University of Tokyo and the Earthquake Research Institute, has, as one of the participants told us, systematically been involved in shutting down any state grants. They have the power, this section of the Tokyo University has the power to distribute funding into precursor research, and it's all going to strictly seismological research, and everything that they come up with is systematically attacked and shut down. This one participant was able to tell us that this was this happened to one of his colleagues personally. So, you know, that's definitely something where they see it. But they have the kind of idealism that comes from being a real scientist, that they don't expect a return, they don't expect recognition or gratification, but they know that it's important. They're also very aware that if they get the funding, if the instrumentation is set up, and if it's centralized, if the data, all the different phenomena, the different ranges of the electromagnetic spectrum on the different parts of the atmosphere and ionosphere and from space are being measured, if all that's brought together, they're totally certain that we could definitely set up a real-time warning system. And so they're committed, and they're just saying there has to be much more cooperation, and they're doing it. I mean, it's, you know... Professor Biaggi had on his... What's that?
I was going to say, on that note, there is a question from your colleague Madeline in Germany, who wanted you to elaborate a little bit on this battle over the method of forecasting, because one of the things that LaRouche has been talking about is the need for an array of instrumentation. And it seems from the reports that I've seen from you and from the work we're doing overall that the people doing this research are clear on what you might call the Kepler model, which is that you have to incorporate an array of sensing devices and instrumentation from which you can find anomalies and then search through the anomalies for a hypothesis. So from your discussions, would you say this is fairly clear about the method of approach that many of these people are taking?
Most definitely, most definitely. They every single person that we interviewed, we did video interviews with seven of the presenters, and they all made that point. They made the point that you can't. There's a lot of things going on, right, in the atmosphere and the ionosphere of space. I mean, we from the basement work, we know this best of all because we've been looking at all the things from solar and extrasolar sources. But they make that point very clearly all the time. We can't just rely on one phenomenon. We can't just rely on one or two parameters. We have to take as many as we can into account before we can really, we can really be sure that we have something to do with the seismic phenomenon oncoming. So that's definitely the case, and that's very interesting because, yeah, as you say, they're not looking for a correlation, right? They're not looking for some kind of Copernican Ptolemaian model, which then they can say, well, now I can explain to you how this works. No, they're actually really looking to how can we make precise forecasts with which lives can be saved and civilization can, prepare to deal with the kind of destruction and prevent it as much as possible. So I think that's definitely a fair comment.
Well, you're listening to The LaRouche Show, and we have with us a very special guest who just attended a major international conference in Vienna, Austria, Daniel Grassen-Achtenta. And Daniel, I'll come back to you in a moment, but I'd like to bring in our other guest, Jason Ross, who was last week at a major conference with the Diane Sayre Congressional Campaign in New Jersey, and Jason is someone who's working in the basement on this. Jason, from what you've just heard from Daniel, how does that correspond to what we're finding from the work we're doing out of the basement of outreach into this community?
I think it corresponds with it very well. The main thing that we've been finding is that it's two things. One is that there are very clear precursors, there are very clear paths of exploration that we should pursue to develop a real science of earthquake forecasting. And the second thing that we're certainly finding is that there is a Zeus-like, I'll get into the story of Zeus in a second, that there's an absolutely oligarchical attempt to kill these types of studies, although it might be performed by people who consider themselves academics and want to maintain their position. Politically, what we know from the Obama administration, going back to 1990, when Gore was part of a group that ended U.S. efforts to determine when earthquakes would occur and switch our focus instead to rebuilding and, how to evacuate people and how to build buildings stronger, that there, it's been said, we cannot know how earthquakes happen. Now, as Daniel pointed out, it's a very young science. So it's anybody who says that we'll never be able to figure it out, it's beyond presumption. It's political. Just give a little bit of background on that. We had been in the basement studying the broader phenomenon known as cosmic radiation. So this led us to conclusions about the relationship between biological diversity or evolution on the Earth and the path of our sun through the galaxy. We had found connections between weather, climate over the years, and not just our sun, but again, the path of the sun through the galaxy. So pretty much any phenomenon you try to investigate on the Earth, whether it be in life in the form of evolution, whether it's physics in the terms of something like nuclear decay, whether it's the weather, there's always an influence on it that lies outside of the Earth, that you can't understand things just from the Earth. Now, when it comes to earthquakes, although obviously the major part of an earthquake is the Earth quaking, hence its name, there are so many things that are seen with it. We have, going back to the Greeks and the Romans, numerous stories about funny smells, a different atmosphere, hazes, unusual cloudiness, strange animal and also plant behaviors that preceded earthquakes and also sometimes volcanic eruptions. We have, with our newer apparatus today, the opportunity to measure a whole variety of things. The infrared emissions from fault areas, the electromagnetic fields in the low frequency range in the area of earthquakes. We've got the ability through satellites to actually look at the ground with such precision that we can see it moving on a scale of, say, a millimeter. So we're able to actually watch shifts in the ground and then note, say, before an earthquake occurs. These kinds of motions can be seen beforehand. So, there are various theories that are put forward for why each of these events might be seen with earthquakes. It's at a point right now already where, you know, some of the people that Daniel had mentioned, say Pulanets, Uzunov, Biagi, where the ability to make forecasts is already there to some degree. The ability to spend a relative pittance to expand this field and make it into a full-fledged science is available before us, but as you had asked, Charlie, about the response of the Obama administration, you know, we've got a American satellite that's proposed called the Destiny. Now, the way this satellite works, it works in a way that's similar to ones that the Europeans have already launched a couple, the Russians already have a couple. It uses an advanced type of radar technique to get an incredibly accurate mapping of the ground and its motion down to the millimeter range. It's been pushed back and pushed back. Its launch date had been pushed back to, I think, 2016. And now, even with this Japan earthquake, even with the fear that people have about the other earthquakes that are occurring around the world, even with the vulnerability on our West Coast, the United States, Obama set the budget for the Destiny satellite to zero, completely canceling the program. So you got to ask,
as part of the overall cuts in a number of other areas of NASA that would enable us to do different kinds of observations with satellites and also planting things on the Moon and Mars.
Yeah, there are seismometers on the Moon, which are no longer active. They were placed there by the Apollo astronauts. But they found very interesting connections between the occurrence of moonquakes and the position of the Moon relative to the Earth against the stars. So the Obama cuts, which we're seeing in all fields, but you're seeing it particularly, it's also particularly compelling when you think about the amount of money that's going to Wall Street bailouts. You think about the very small amount of money that NASA gets already, and then you consider the tiny amount of money for this program. The only reason for making decisions like this is that you want to kill people. I mean, the outlook, as expressed by the World Wildlife Fund, the imperial outlook is a small world population as it existed before the gifts of Prometheus, before civilization had a serious conscious understanding of its ability to understand how the world works, and that's your identity as a human species.
You know, and this is where you say the Zeus oligarchical approach, which really, one of the reasons Prometheus gave fire to man was because he knew Zeus was about to wipe out the human race. So,
right.
Let me go back to Daniel for a second, because something that you raised, Jason, I think is relevant, and I'd like to see if this was discussed at this conference in Vienna, which is the broader question of the relationship between the galactic cycles, the 62 million year cycles, and so on. And now we have the 11-year cycle of solar activity, which seems to be extended to 13 years at this point. With the reporting, I believe, from Japan and maybe even from Professor Biagi's operation of the X-level flares and coronal emissions from the sun preceding both the New Zealand quake and the Japan quake. Daniel, was there some discussion of these kinds of questions at the conference? Is this a general awareness?
Well, there was Dr. Gerald Duma from the Geodynamics Institute in Austria. He's Viennese local. He gave an extended presentation on the correlation between solar activity and seismic activity. He made the point that there's a 3-year lag of average geomagnetic potential, the so-called KP value, of 3 years lag behind sunspot occurrences or activity, if you want to call it that. But he also said that there's a 1-to-1 match of solar wind activity and this seismic activity. And these are areas which other participants pointed out there's not a causal relationship, and I think it's correct. But the correlation shows that we are, that does tell us we're going into a more heightened activity. But yes, in general, there was a lot of openness to it. They didn't, most of the participants hadn't looked into that themselves. I brought up with a number of them that the seismograph on the moon had registered a lot of events that obviously wouldn't be explainable from a strictly earthbound model of tectonics and so forth, and that was always picked up with intrigue. And obviously we handed to each of the people that we talked to, all of the professors got, for example, Sky Shield's excellent article which he wrote after Keisha Rogers won the Democratic nomination in the 22nd district of Texas, where it's a very condensed presentation of the different cycles and the different signs or the different records that we have that really show us that there are longer term cycles that make the Earth more sensitive and life on Earth more sensitive to volatile activity from outside. There was no discussion of that per se, but they were all very open to it. Basically, their line was, we have a lot of work to do ourselves. If somebody else were to look into that, we'd be very interested to see what they come up with.
You mentioned this one professor who was doing from Austria, who was doing work on the correlation between solar and seismic activity. I believe we had a report from before this conference that Professor Biaggi had been talking about that in terms of some work in Japan. Was there anything presented on that at the conference from the Japanese group?
No, there wasn't, not this time. I don't know the specifics on that, but they're very... Yeah, they. I mean, they're very clear that they had the signals in advance. That's for sure. And Mr. Hayakawa, Professor Hayakawa, was on a. There was an article written up on him as someone who actually did predict the earthquake. So I can't say anything to that directly. No.
Well, let me ask another question on this question of forecasting. There are those who are saying that they expect something that's a little close to home for me, which is the west coast of the United States. And, of course, there were these conferences hearings in the Congress sponsored by Representative Wu from Oregon, where they revealed that there's almost no preparedness other than this duck and cover and hold routine, which is not exactly comforting. So... Was there much of a sense from of this that the rim of fire is volatile for the next year or two, and there could be a major earthquake on the west coast of the United States?
Well, sure. I mean, that's the very useful thing about having a solid correlation between solar activity, geomagnetic activity, and seismic activity is not so much that you could. It's difficult to say that there's a causal relationship, but what it does show you is that there is an expectation of really powerful activity up and coming, and that was Mr. Duma's main point, that he expects a seismic maximum going into 2017. There were some sort of discrepancies in what he expected because of the unusually long solar cycle that this one is. So that's why he put it on 2017. But generally, yes, all of the people that we talked to, all of these professors and researchers said that is what they expect, based on that kind of viewpoint. And also, going back to what Jason said before about really, I mean, the monetary aspect, financing these instruments is a pittance. I mean, you know, this is pocket, this is loose change that Zeus has in his pocket, which he's denying. Professor Biaggi, to even set up the few stations that he has, had to get €100,000 loan from the local private bank to fund that. And he says that that to set up, they have only 7 stations to measure very low frequency wave radio waves in Europe. And he said you would need, well, maybe 20 to 30 of these things, which would cost several hundred thousand euros to set up. And it's really, really not a big deal. I mean, you know, you're talking about basic radio transmitters, receivers on certain frequencies. And then they could analyze the data. Obviously, you'd need a bit of support on that end. Mr. Hobara, representing his and Hayakawa's work, said to cover the whole surface of Japan with magnetometers to measure fluctuations in the magnetic field, which is another side of their work, would cost, well, each one costs 4 million yen, which is, I think, only several hundred thousand U.S. dollars per unit. And that's very clear. You know, this is money that, I mean, I wouldn't really want to guess how much the party and the drinks and everything at this EGU conference cost, but probably, you know, a lot of money gets thrown away on things which have nothing to do with this kind of thing.
Also, Michel Perrault told us that.
Yeah, Perrault also told us that the Demeter satellite was initially only planned to run for 2 years, but they pressured the government, or they pressured whoever was funding it, and said, look, if we are even going to be able to gather any kind of significant amount of data, we need to be up there for a long enough time to have seismic events happen so we have measurements. And that's how it got extended to a fourfold of what the original, you know, whatever the accountant or whatever the funding department had initially projected the satellite to be active for. And they were very emphatic on the point that you just need a lot of them to measure different measure these different phenomena up there 24/7, and you need a team on the ground that can do the analysis.
Well, you're listening to the LaRouche Show, and we're engaging in a discussion with Daniel Grass and Aktenta from Germany, who's with the BUSO website there from Berlin, and also Jason Ross from the basement. I want to call your attention, you should put this on your calendar now. April 19th is the next webcast with Lyndon LaRouche, April 19th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And also, he will be again on the weekly report this coming Wednesday. The last few of these have included discussions with Sky Shields, and the last one with Ouyang Teng as well. And Daniel, I understand you got some copies of the weekly reports out to the scientists you met with in Vienna.
That's right, all except the very last one. But the ones starting with the post-earthquake discussion Sky Shields and Lyndon LaRouche on a DVD, also with the presentations on the Rim of Fire and different LPAC TV reports, they all got that.
Well, LPAC TV, and I'm sure also the BUSO site, will be the best places to go for people to be informed, and not just informed, but to take action, to reverse this insanity of the continued bailouts and the budget cuts while we're destroying the potential for mankind to survive. Now, Jason, I want to get back to you on this question of the cycles. We just had a very fascinating report put up by Natalie Lovgren on the LaRouche PAC site, where she shows that contrary to the manipulation of statistics by the U.S. Geological Survey, who claim that there's no increase in major earthquakes, what Natalie shows is that, in fact, we have seen a significant increase, I believe, from 6 to 13 earthquakes over magnitude 8 in the last decade. We're now entering into this period of solar, an expanded solar cycle. What is it that, just give us a sense of some of these cycles beyond the 11 to 13 year cycle. What other cycles are coming into play, including the longer term one that we're now, for the first time ever as a human civilization, going into an area of our galaxy which has been an area where there's been the most violent disruptions of life in the past?
Well, you'd mentioned the 11 and 13 year cycles as well as Natalie's report. What Natalie had gone through is that, yes, contrary to the USGS, although the number of total earthquakes is what's often used in statistics, might not be increasing, if you look at the actual amount of energy that comes out in earthquakes, or the number of very powerful earthquakes, the statistics paint a very different picture. For example, the two major, before the Japan earthquake, if you considered all of the earthquakes in the past 100 years, a mere two of them, the Alaska 1964 earthquake and Chile 1960 earthquake, represented two-thirds of the total energy of all earthquakes in the 100 years from 1906 to 2005. That's just two earthquakes. So when you consider the power of earthquakes and not the number of small ones, you see that, yes, it certainly has been increasing recently. As far as the larger cycles you had asked about, we've been able to determine that in the past we see these changes in biological diversity, et cetera, but also changes in the composition of the Earth. So this includes volcanic activity and the like that is there correlated with these 62-million-year cycles. The relationship between the cosmic radiative environment and earthquakes isn't clear at this point, but given that we see electromagnetic, particularly ionospheric changes preceding earthquakes, during and after them as well, means that these aren't just caused by earthquakes, but they could also be part of a broader process that includes earthquakes, but we might determine that there's actually more going on than the earthquake making an electromagnetic signal beforehand. That there might be something going in the opposite direction as well. I did want to also bring up, you know, Daniel was just discussing how Professor Biaggi had to get a 100,000 euro loan himself to finance his work. In cycles research, the same thing occurred to Henrik Stensmark, who famously had put forward the hypothesis that cosmic radiation was connected to cloud formation and therefore the climate. When he wanted to do a pretty cheap experiment, I believe his was also about 100,000 euros, he was unable to get funding from any university and had to go fundraising from he eventually found a Danish businessman who was willing to help him out on it. We're finding this also in the United States with other work. There's a man named Tom Blyer in California, for example, who has set up 60 low-frequency electromagnetic field detectors in California as part of a project he calls QuakeFinder, which is similar to what Daniel described Hayakawa in Japan proposing for his country. And it's all privately financed. Meanwhile, the USGS is not only not funding these things, but is saying that basically, I'd like to actually read a quote from Geller here.
Please do.
Okay, this is from 1999. The journal Nature had a debate about earthquake prediction. And so here's a couple of them that Geller had sent then. He said that no satisfactory theory of earthquake source process exists at present. Further work should be encouraged, but it will probably lead to a better understanding of why prediction is effectively impossible, rather than to effective methods for prediction. I'll read a second one here. He also said, quote, in view of the bleak prospects, there is no obvious need for specialized organizations and research programs for prediction. Researchers in this area should seek funding through normal peer-reviewed channels. This would probably lead to an almost complete phasing out of prediction research, not because of censorship, but rather owing to the poor quality of most present work in this field.
And, of course, Geller would probably sit on those peer review committees that would deny the funding.
But exactly. So, but I mean, in my mind, I think it's pretty funny that here you've got this guy who's supposedly, I'm thinking, what do you study? If you're a seismologist, this is your life's work, you're studying earthquakes, and you think it's fundamentally impossible to predict when they're going to occur, what are you doing all day? What's your job? You know, what else is there to it? You know, giving an overall idea of what insurance rates should be in a certain county because it's earthquake prone? I mean, I don't know. You know, it's like, what else, you know, really, what else? I mean,
this brings up one of the other questions that we should take a little bit of time on, which is this whole question of forecasting and the denial of forecastability, which you have the same problem in economics.
Yeah.
And I'll throw out to either of you, One of the points Lyndon LaRouche made yesterday in a discussion is that this is precisely why we have to reject, show that the second law of thermodynamics is nothing but an ideological fraud, and get to real science, which is the Riemannian-Vernadsky-type approach. And maybe one of you would like to just talk about that a bit, as it applies to earthquakes, but also to physical economics.
Well, we might both want to say something, but I'll start anyhow. It is amazing the similarity in expression between economists and these earthquake scientists. In both cases, you're studying a field which is supposedly unpredictable and unknowable, which makes you wonder what you're studying. But you see it with the free market, where the outlook, the Adam Smith, the British outlook, the argument runs that economies work well on their own without regulation. You can't know what will happen exactly, but you do know that if you try to manipulate it, something bad will happen. So that if you try to regulate the economy, if you try to direct it somewhere that's good, the results will always be bad, and it has to be left on its own. So then you get all these economists, you know, as we've seen with LaRouche's forecast, that they've disagreed with him. They've said it's impossible for the economy to collapse. There's no way it can ever happen. Then, when he's right, they go back and say, no one could have ever seen it coming.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's been their frame. No one saw it coming. We had no idea. Again, you wonder, why are you on the job? You know, what are
and
you...
Daniel, you had something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's really good that you bring it up in those terms, because that really is the fundamental question of science, right? That if you understand a process, if you actually know what the principle is that is generating it, then you are able to make statements about a future state in that process. And that is exactly what is being denied here. And I think even just a preliminary look into history, at any point that society, science, has ever said, there's no more progress, we can't know anything more on this, that's always been a failure, and that's always been a sign of a doomed society. Whenever humanity has accepted that, and then it's really just a matter of time before there's a collapse into barbarism, you know, general occultism, mysticism, because basically then you're appealing to mystical forces. And it was just funny that after the first interview that we did with the French and Polish researchers, we were immediately approached by a guy called Max Wyss, who approached us in the most hostile and arrogant manner by saying that, why do you interview the people who give the worst presentations? But then he even went further, and when we were discussing the whole thing, we basically said, look, this is an important phenomenon, and it's very young, it should be continued research, basically expressing our that we couldn't understand where his position came from. And he went into a whole thing about how this kind of research gives what seismologists do a bad name, yada, yada, yada. But then in the end he said, the reason earthquakes are fundamentally a random phenomenon, and the thing that you cannot account for is, dramatic pause, random influences. Ooh. And got a very weird look on his face. And when we didn't respond to that, he stood up and said, well, you just live in your fantasy world then if you want to, and left in a huff.
Well, the actual fantasy—the fantasy world is the world that these people live in. But I was just thinking with what both of you just said of the critical role in this of Friedrich Nietzsche and his whole theory of cyclical changes, but changes which repeat the same cycles. There's no progress, no change. And this idea, when we were talking earlier about the Prometheus versus Zeus, Jason, you brought that up, and you said you'd talk more about it. But we really are dealing with something that it's almost an imperial diktat, which says, we say there will be no predictability or forecasting, therefore there will be none. And they destroy the science that would actually give us that.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, for sure.
Right. I mean, it's funny, there's a lot of supposed principles out there to which exceptions exist. So, for example, you know, the second law of thermodynamics exists only in a world in which there's no life or cognition. So, you know, a physicist, and actually not even this, but, you know, a physicist who's looking at a steam engine, for example, would say, yes, the second law of thermodynamics is true. Now, the whole universe isn't a steam engine, of course. So whenever, at various points in the past, when we thought, or when foolish people thought that we had discovered everything that there was to know, we knew all of the forces of nature, we've always been wrong. And it's remarkably presumptuous for anybody to say that in any field we've either discovered everything that there is to know or that we know is fundamentally random. There's a very good parallel between earthquake science and quantum mechanics. In both cases, as far as quantum mechanics goes, within about 25 years of the discovery of quantum phenomena by Planck and Einstein, the official line was fundamentally random, that the process itself was statistical, that there was no actual real world down in the very small. There were only different odds and probabilities of having observations, but that there was no reality. Totally explicit on that. You get the same thing now with the earthquake science, where, I guess Witz had told Daniel that the earthquakes were random. Geller, in debates, likes to use the word stochastic instead. It sounds more intelligent, but it means the same thing. That, you know, they're saying by its nature, we know its nature, and it's random.
Right.
Well, you know, on this, I'd like to actually just extend the discussion a little bit, because I was going to say that the one bit of evidence you can find to the second law of thermodynamics is you look at the U.S. Congress or perhaps the Merkel government. But, Daniel, I'd like you to relate this to what's actually happening in Germany now, where you have the assertion of randomness and chaos and the use of the Japanese disaster to promote the most anti-scientific, anti-nuclear, greeny model, which is now taking over the state of Baden-Württemberg and really threatens the whole country, a country which is synonymous historically with scientific advance. So, you know, as someone who is actively involved in the political fight in Germany, give us just a quick update on what's going on with this crazy environmentalist movement.
Well, yeah, I mean, for people who don't know, basically the callousness of the media, which is as green as most of the parties are, was shown after the earthquake when the first news came out that the Fukushima Daiichi, that's the reactor power plant number one, was having problems, there was an immediate total focus shift away. Suddenly, people were not in danger from an earthquake and a tsunami, but if you weren't paying attention, from all the reports and all the television hype that you saw, you would have thought that actually the suffering that thousands of people were subjected to was actually coming from this power plant, from this nuclear plant. And that created such a mass hysteria and angst, which I think you've discussed in this program once before, that actually has led to a kind of a political coup d'etat, where basically you've had a Gleichschaltung, a total, all of the parties are now green. The last vestiges of pro-technology, the last vestiges of what was good in the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union of Merkel, or even the FDP, the Liberal Party, which is otherwise economically liberal, was their pro-technology stance. That's gone, and everybody's basically on a total, they're in lockstep now on the green paradigm. One party is trying to outdo the other in being green. Now that obviously is fatal, because first of all, there are many people, and I would say there's still a majority that is not green in this country. There's a lot of people that are just, all that is doing is actually disillusioning people from the democratic process, because people say, well, what's the difference? They're all the same. And that was the same, that was the case with economic policy for a long time in terms of deregulation, liberalization. But now in times of this, in terms of really anti-nuclear hysteria, that's the case here now too. I mean, we're 10,000 kilometers, almost 10,000 kilometers away from Japan, from Fukushima. And when a tiny amount of increase of radiation was measured here, everybody got totally upset and afraid. You shouldn't eat spinach from Japan, all these kinds of things. Really ridiculous. One thing, I think it cannot be sustained, and that's due to our work. But also, you cannot maintain such a level of hysteria, and that's the only reason the Green Party got the vote that they got in Baden-Württemberg, which is traditionally, and still today, the most dense concentration of industry in this country, especially at the Mittelstand. And you just cannot keep that up the whole time. They've tried to do it now can't really call it 7.4 an aftershock, I think. They've tried to do that. But I think this really gets to the point that what we need to really free people from, those people who know that we need industry, that we need productivity, that we need energy flux dense energy sources, that we can't rely on all of this windmills and solar panels that don't work half the time. Now, one of the crazy things about us shutting down 7 nuclear power plants in the recent weeks is now we're importing more nuclear power electrical energy from other countries than we ever were before, right? Because we can't cover it, because you just cannot produce the amount of energy demands from these other sources. And so that's sort of an ironic effect of the shutdown of nuclear plants here, is that now Czech and French power, where they happily produce with nuclear plants, is being imported en masse to come up for the shortfall.
But, well, that sort of gets to the theme I wanted to explore for this program today, which is science as statecraft, that we're not merely talking about scientific anomalies that are interesting, you know, as in a popular science right. article, but we're actually talking about science as a life and death issue, and this concept that Lyndon LaRouche has introduced as the question of a platform, that you uplift and transform everything in a society based on scientific discovery. That is, Jason, wouldn't you say that is an absolute physical principle almost, that if you don't do that, you do face extinction?
Absolutely. I mean, every species in history, everything goes extinct. The only possibility for non-extinction lies with us. The Earth's atmosphere, climate, environment, temperatures, water cover, atmosphere, these things all change. They never change in the same way, though, is an important thing. That although the 62-million-year cycle, we call it a cycle, instead of imagining a circle, imagine the shape of a spiral, like a spring or a slinky. Yes, it does have a periodicity to it, but it's always moving forward. That every time we've had a mass extinction, so-called mass extinction in the biological history of our planet, we've also seen a dramatic upshift in the types of biological, let's say, technologies employed by life. So that, we haven't seen regressions in life. You know, we haven't lost all warm-blooded animals. You know, we're not heading in a direction where animals are all going to lose their sense organs and skeletons and, become sea jellies again or something like that. It's always moving forward. And it makes sense for us as the species that's able to understand that to also represent that in our behavior. So that when we're acting naturally, if you want to be a greenie, if you want to be like nature, then you've got to be like nature. You've got to be developing and moving onwards and contributing to the increased creative power of ourselves and of life and everything else. And that's when you're being like nature, when you're growing. If you try to act the same, that never happens.
Well, there's no such thing as a steady state anywhere.
No, I mean, plus it's peculiar. Like, basically these greenies, they've arbitrarily picked some sort of time in their minds, probably sometime in the 1960s, and they think that was just the best state of the planet and that whatever puts us back that way would be great. You say, okay, well, there were less deserts in North Africa 40 years ago, but I'm sure they'd oppose, greening the deserts. I mean, there's nothing good about any particular state of life, of environment, of landform, of anything. There's no inherent good in any of these conditions. The actual value, the constant, lies in the development. So instead of saying, you know, let's maintain this particular aspect of an environment or something like that, now, I'm all for having beautiful parks, okay? You know, I like going outside. But the idea of saying that maintaining everything stationary is somehow a good is insane. All you're saying is everything we do is bad, just sort of as an axiom. And that's Zeus. That's saying that human beings, being characteristically human, changing things, is inherently bad. That's what the green movement is. It's just saying we hate people.
Yeah. Daniel, you're involved in. Oh, go ahead.
No, that's the point to be made. That exactly that we do need to be serious about how does nature function, and we're going to be producing a lot of the video product that LaRouche Pack has put out in German for the audience here, because that's what I think will liberate a lot of people and people that are now in reserve to go on the offensive, to get out of what they think is a technical debate and realize, well, look, if you're going to be political now, the only way you're going to have any kind of political success is to study the fundamental principles of the universe and the development over geological time, because that's the only way that you can get a sense of what appropriate activity we have to take up now, given the threats and given the an interest in long-term survival of humanity. And we just have to, sure, I mean, if the 68ers thought that the Big Bang started in 1968, well, we can expand their horizon a little bit. That's not too bad.
Well, maybe their Big Bang occurred in 1968, and they've been impotent ever since. Now, Daniel, you're going to be working with your colleague, Stefan, who's running a campaign for mayor of Berlin. And in the initial discussion with Mr. LaRouche, this was the whole focus, that it's not just about a local election. It is these global issues. So we just have a couple minutes left. What are you planning, both in terms of putting up reports on the website, but also the campaign, the Tolksdorf campaign and the Busso campaign in Berlin?
Yeah, we've got some events planned. Big conference is going to be hopefully sometime in June. Basically we are going to expand our intervention in terms of video product and also in terms of the events that are ongoing, because these issues are just really going to increase in the next period. We've seen that the Greens think that they can ride on this wave of hysteria and angst, and they think that, you know, Kunas, who's running for mayor, has said, yes, I could also be chancellor, you know. And they're getting very arrogant in a very short period of time. And I think that's a very thermodynamic process, because that's a killer of creativity. And people don't like that fundamentally. And as the economic crisis is increasing, Portugal now is being forced to take up an EU bailout of minimum of 80 billion euros, which they want to rush past through so that they have it by mid-May. And we know that this process is continuing, right? And, you know, they took the opportunity of the Fukushima disaster to make the European Financial Stability Fund a permanent fixture so that the bailout would continue. And people are going to get wise to that, and they are wise to that. They have been seeing that. And, you know, we've seen from our organizing, we've had increased activity throughout the whole country, and people are not as hysterical as the media would have you believe.
I think we're going to have to end at that, because we're just about out of time, and I think you just made the case for why it is that politics cannot function without real science right now, and this is, it's not just a question of dampening hysteria, but if we don't move to a new platform, we will not survive. So I'd like to thank you, Daniel, for joining us. I know you're on the road back to Berlin, so thanks very much, and we'll be looking for your reports on the LaRouche Pack website.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's been great. There'll be interviews also upcoming that we did there.
Great. And Jason, thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll be seeing you turn up somewhere at an event in the near period, or another one of the programs on LPAC TV. So thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of The LaRouche Show, 3 p.m. Eastern. And go to the LaRouche PAC website. And by the way, we talked about the problems with fundraising. Fundraising is an honorable profession because we do it not from corporations and cartels, but from you. So make sure you contribute to LaRouche PAC so that we can continue to do the kind of work that you've heard today. Thanks, and see you next week.